Done, she said abruptly. The worship has been well performed. May he please you and relish you, your beautiful one. The mistress bitch blesses him to you, thanks to Dabubu's arts, which are worth their hire. And the low creature laid aside her lofty tone, stepped back from her labors, wiped her nose with the back of her hand, and put her blood-stained hands in a basin of water to cleanse them. The moon shone out again. Mech, the concubine, came too after her faint. "Is she still there?" she asked, shaking. "Who?" asked Dabubu, scrubbing her hands like a doctor after an operation. "The bitch? Calm yourself, concubine. She has vanished again. She did not want to come. She was enforced by my arts, because I know so well how to get round her and compass her character so tellingly in words. And she could do nothing here but by my will, because I buried under the threshold a threefold spell against evil. But she will perform her task, no question of that. She received the offering, and likewise she is bound by the burnt offering of the woven hair." Mut-Im-Enit, the mistress, heaved a deep, audible sigh, and rose from the hearth where she had crouched. In her white mantle, with the laurel still at her ear, she stood before the carrion flesh with her chin raised and her hands clasped beneath it. Since she had smelt the odor of burning hair, hers and Joseph's mingled, the corners of her half-open, mask-like mouth had sagged more and more bitterly, as though weighted down. It was piteous to see this mouth, with its stiff, tragic lips, to watch them move as in her chanting voice she addressed her plea to the powers above. "Hear me, ye purer spirits, who might have joyed me had ye smiled upon my love to Osarsif, the Ibrian youth. Hear and see me in my misery at this abasement, how anguish sits at my heart for the evil choice I must make, since no other remained to me in my deep despair, to your mistress, sweet Osarsif, my falcon. Ah, ye purer powers, how hard, how oppressive, how shameful is this renunciation of mine! For I have renounced his soul, when at last I yielded and was enforced to this making of magic. Thy soul I renounced, Osarsif, my beloved, and how hard, how bitter to love must this renunciation be! I have renounced your eyes, most anguishing of all, but I could no other. I was helpless and had no choice. When we embrace, thine eyes will be closed and dead, and only thy swelling lips will be mine. How often shall I kiss them, shamed in my bliss? For the breath of thy mouth is dearer than aught else. But more than all, more than aught else, my son youth, would have been the gaze of thy soul, and the lament for its loss welleth up from my depths. Hear, ye purer powers, from beside this hearth of the black arts, in the bitterness of my affliction, I cry to you. Look upon me, a woman of high rank, driven by love to sink beneath it, that I must give my joy for lust, to enjoy, if not the joy of his eyes, at least the delight of his mouth. But woeful and evil it is to me, this renunciation. To me, a daughter of a prince, I cannot but utter it aloud, ye higher powers, cannot but give it voice before I taste this conjured lust and enjoy a soulless bliss with his sweet body. Ye spirits, leave me my secret inmost prayer. Let me hope that at the last the lust and joy may not quite part, so that if the lust be deep enough, love may blossom from it, that beneath my ardent kisses the dead boy's eyes may open, and he may give me his gaze from his soul, so that perhaps after all the hard conditions of this magic art may not hold, but be defeated. In my abasement, ye purer powers, leave me this silent, secret hope. To you I raise my lament. Deny me not the hope of this little defeat, this little, little triumph. And Mut-Im-Enit lifted her arms, and with violent, prolonged sobbing, sank upon the breast of Mech, the concubine, who led her from the roof. New Year's Day. My audience must by now have reached the height of its impatience to hear what, after all, everybody already knows. The hour of satisfaction is at hand, the climax of the story, the chief hour of the feast, which has been since it first came to pass and related itself. The hour and day when Joseph, for 3 years Potiphar's head steward, for 10 his property, just saved himself from the grossest error of his life, escaping from fiery temptation, though as it were with a black eye, and as a result completing a smaller cycle of his life, in that he went down again to the pit by his own error, as he himself realized, and in punishment for behavior so heedless, so provocative, almost, one might say, so wicked, that there was not much to choose between it and his earlier wrongdoing. We are justified in drawing a parallel between his sin against Potiphar's wife and his earlier sin against his brothers. Once more he had gone too far in his craving to make people sit up. Once more the working of his charm, which it was his good right to employ, for his own enjoyment and for the honor and profit of his God, had been allowed to get beyond control, to degenerate into an actual danger. In his first life, these workings had taken the negative form of hate. This time, the immoderately positive and equally destructive form of passion. He had, in his blindness, given fuel to the flames of both. In the second case, misled by his own response to a woman's uncontrollable passion, he who stood in such need of instruction himself had tried to play the pedagogue. His conduct cried out for retribution. There is no doubt of that. But we cannot help smiling to see how the punishment which so justly overtook him was directed to the furtherance of a good fortune much greater and more brilliant than that which had been destroyed. The source of our amusement is the insight which these events afford into the mental processes of exalted spheres. Far back in the very pre-beginnings of history, we have seen that the fallibility of the creature man was a source of dissatisfaction to certain circles. What is man that thou art mindful of him? The question always hovered on certain lips, and was an embarrassment to the Creator, who saw himself driven to pay tribute to the kingdom of the stern and let justice have its way. Clearly less of his own motion than under a moral pressure from which he could not well escape. The present instance is a delightful example of his dignified bowing to the storm, while at the same time having his little game with the austere and disgruntled ones, practicing the art of healing where he chastened, and making misfortune a fruitful soil whence renewed good fortune should spring. The day of decision, the turning point, was the great feast day of the official new year, the day of the beginning of the rise of the Nile and of Amun's visit to his southern house of women. The official new year, be it noted, for the actual day when the sacred cycle closed, the dog star rose once more in the morning sky, and the waters began to mount, was by no means the same day. In this respect, disorder reigned in Egypt, where it was otherwise so much detested. It did happen, through time, men's lives, and kingly dynasties, that the actual new year coincided with the calendar. But only in 1,460 years did this come to pass. Almost 48 generations must live without experience of it, which they did not mind at all, by comparison with other of life's manifold cares. The century in which Joseph's Egyptian course was run was not vouchsafed the pleasure of beholding the beauty inherent in the union of the actual and the formal. The children of Kemp, who lived and laughed and wept beneath Egypt's sun, simply knew no more than that the two did not coincide, and it mattered to them not at all. Not that they celebrated the new year, Achet, the rise of the Nile, at a time when actually they were in the middle of the harvest, Shemu, but they did so in the winter season, Peret, also called the time of the sowing. And if the children of Kemp saw nothing strange in that, for an irregularity which will go on for another 1,000 years is, after all, regularity of a sort, Joseph, for his part, did. He even found it comic, by reason of his inward detachment respecting the life and customs of the Egyptians. He kept the irregular feast, as he did all those of the Netherland, with reservations, and with just that amount of indulgence which he considered justified from above in respect of his worldly participation. It is worthwhile to point out in passing, and is almost a cause of amazement, that a person having so much critical detachment from the sphere where he lived, and from activities to him fundamentally foolish, could yet take life seriously enough to achieve all that Joseph achieved, and accomplish all the good that he was destined to accomplish. But whether a detached mind took it seriously or no, the day of the official rise of the Nile was celebrated in all Egypt, and especially in Noet Amun, the hundred-gated Waysay, with a solemnity which we can only realize by comparing it with one of our own great national and popular festivals. The whole city was on its legs from early dawn, and its huge population, greatly exceeding 100,000, as we know, was still further increased by hordes of country folk from upriver and down, streaming in to celebrate Amun's great day in the god's own seat. They mingled among the citizens, open-mouthed, hopping on one leg, staring at the city's majestic sights, the glory of which made up to the betaxed and belabored little peasantry for the gray poverty of the whole past year, and strengthened their patriotism for the floggings of the one to come. In a sweating throng, their noses full of the odors of burnt fat, the fragrance from mountains of flowers, they filled the gay, canopied, alabaster-paven forecourts of the temples, which echoed with sacred chorales, glowed with color, and were full to bursting with abundance of heaped-up food and drink of every sort and kind. There, this one day, they might fill their bellies at the expense of the god, or rather of the higher powers, who robbed and exploited the whole year round, but now smiled in extravagant generosity. They might, against their own better knowledge, lull themselves in the dream that it would always be thus, that with this feast the golden age of free beer and roast goose had dawned, and never again would the tax-gatherers come, accompanied by Nubians bearing palm rods, to harass the little peasantry, but every day would be like the temple of Amun-Re, wherein they saw a drunken woman with flowing hair spending her days in riotous living because she held the king of the gods.